worst offenders, Canada, the U.S., Australia, and the U.K. Additionally, the world's largest fossil fuel companies employing the same companies that receive government contracts to militarize their borders. Harjit, your response.
Well, the reality is that people who are getting displaced because of climate change, that number is increasing. And when policymakers should be alarmed with those numbers and coming up with responses so that we can help these people, the surveillance industry, as you mentioned, Amy, has seen a business opportunity. And they are using it in a very divisive manner just to make money. Whereas these people who are being displaced, and majority of them stay in their own country, you know, a fraction of that population crosses borders, and a fraction of that population then crosses international borders. So in those circumstances, we first need to talk about providing support to people so that they do not have to cross borders. And crossing borders means they are living in a real desperate situation. And that's why they leave everything and cross borders and take so much of risk. So instead of, you know, this particular crisis providing opportunity to the surveillance industry to make money, we all should be coming together and showing solidarity to these people who are getting displaced and support them so that they can rebuild their lives.
We want to thank you so much of Climate Action Network. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
This is David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we go in depth about the Sudan, formerly a colony of the UK and Egypt. Its history goes back to the days of the pharaohs. The Sudan is located in North Africa, bordering the Red Sea, Egypt, Libya, Chad, the Central African Republic. And in 1989, on June 30th, Lieutenant Omar el-Bashir seized power in a coup d'etat, and he ruled the Sudan for 30 years. Now, keep in mind that Sudan was the largest country on the continent of Africa until it was divided in a U.S.-backed deal in 2011 with the secession of the oil-rich South Sudan. And in December of 2018, protests broke out in several cities across the Sudan against worsening living conditions and rising costs of living. Those protests morphed quickly into a mass movement against President Omar al-Bashir, calling for his resignation. And indeed, he was forced to step down, the military, of course, taking credit for removing him. An interesting thing to note about the protests is that we've seen some reports that say 70% of the protesters who have gone out onto the streets are women. This is according to the BBC. Now, after al-Bashir's ousting, demonstrators organized, likely by a number of people, but the organization that seems to be doing the coordination is the Sudanese Professionals Association, and they are demanding democracy. They are demanding civilian rule. The military has ruled Sudan since the removal of Omar al-Bashir, and negotiations had begun, and so the protesters held off for a while, both in late April and early May, and but then that stopped when the military government killed an estimated 118 people and injured others in Sudan's capital on June the 3rd. And after that, the opposition led a three-day general strike, very effective three-day general strike. But then the negotiations, the opposition agreed to end the strike because the military government said that they would agree to free political prisoners, and there were renewed negotiations, but those negotiations fell apart. A draft proposal from Ethiopia in an attempt to settle the matter did not. And so this past Sunday, June 30th, protesters hit the streets again in the millions from some reports. And the protests also commemorated the 30th anniversary of the coup that brought former President Omar al-Bashir to power in 1989. So a lot going on during this hour as we dig in to what the Sudan and its history, and our guests are Dr. Nada Mustafa Ali and Professor Khalid Mustafa Medani. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. Republican Glenn Youngkin has won the Virginia governor's race, a major political turnabout in a state that had been trending increasingly blue. Young managed to appeal to the Trump Republican base while keeping Trump himself at arm's length and never campaigning with him. He tapped into culture war fights over schools and race. Polls showed the race tightening after Democrat Terry McAuliffe said during a late September debate he didn't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach. That prompted Youngkin to run hundreds of TV ads on the statement and to focus on his own pledges to make school curricula less, quote, un-American, and to overhaul policies on transgender students in school bathrooms. The race took an especially bitter turn last week. That's when Youngkin ran an ad featuring a mother and Republican activist who 8 years ago led an effort to ban Beloved, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Black Nobel laureate Toni Morrison, from classrooms. In his victory speech last night, Youngkin again highlighted the issues of schools and curriculum.
Friends, we're gonna embrace our parents, not ignore them. We're gonna press forward with a curriculum that includes listening to parents' input.
The political newcomer Youngkin beat McAuliffe by 2 percentage points. President Biden won Virginia by 10 points last year. It's a nail biter in the New Jersey governor's race, where Republican former state assemblymember Jack Cittarelli is ahead by 1,000 votes out of more than 2.3 million cast. Heavily Democratic areas have yet to be counted, so incumbent Governor Phil Murphy could yet pull out a victory. Democratic former police captain Eric Adams won the New York mayor's race. Boston voters elected city councilor Michelle Wu as the city's first female and Asian American mayor. The mayoral race in Buffalo put India Walton, a Democratic socialist, in a rematch with incumbent mayor Byron Brown, who was the city's first Black mayor and a Democrat, who lost the primary to Walton this summer. Brown ran a write-in campaign and won. Minneapolis voters rejected a ballot initiative that sought to overhaul policing in their city, where George Floyd was murdered by police officer Derek Chauvin last year. The initiative would have replaced the police force with the Department of Public Safety. 28 million children as young as 5 could start receiving their kid-sized Pfizer vaccinations against COVID-19 today. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Rochelle Walensky approved the vaccine shortly after an advisory committee recommended she do so. Pediatricians' offices, pharmacies, hospitals, schools, and health clinics are poised to begin the shots. Pfizer said it expects to make 19,000 shipments totaling about 11 million doses in the next several days, and that millions more will be available to order on a weekly basis. Democrats say they've reached agreement on a plan to lower prescription drug costs for older people as part of the Build Back Better plan. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says it would empower Medicare to negotiate lower prices. He said it's not as sweeping as Democrats had hoped for, but a compromise struck with a key holdout in the party.
By empowering Medicare to directly negotiate prices in Part B and Part D, this deal will directly reduce out-of-pocket drug spending for millions of patients every time they visit the pharmacy or doctor. It will cap out-of-pocket spending at $2,000 per year, ending the days where a life-changing diagnosis could mean thousands upon thousands of dollars in new expenses. And it will reform the entire industry to stop price gouging. And Senator Sinema has told me she supports this agreement.
The agreement signals the party is moving closer to wrapping up negotiations on the $1.75 trillion plan. President Biden said his plan will have the support of another key holdout, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin. Manchin hasn't said yet he's agreed. Schumer said he expects a Senate vote on November 15th. President Biden and other world leaders have returned home from the COP26 International Climate Summit, leaving details to be hammered out by negotiators. One of the key questions is helping to finance poor nations' adaptation to the effects of climate change and their transition to a greener energy future. The rich countries failed to follow through with their previous commitment for a $100 billion annual climate fund that was supposed to begin last year. The University of California Hastings College of Law wants to remove the name of its founder, who sponsored massacres of Native Americans in the 1850s. Hastings was founded in 1878 by Sir Annis Clinton Hastings. He was a wealthy rancher and former California Supreme Court Chief Justice. He helped orchestrate and finance campaigns by white settlers in California's northern Mendocino County to kill and enslave members of the Yuki Indian tribe. I'm Eileen Alfandari for Pacifica Radio.
Those were our news headlines, and this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We are going to spend the hour learning about Sudan's early history, and then the separation of Sudan, with South Sudan establishing itself, the forces that make up the military, what is happening on the ground. And before I welcome our guests, let's go to a clip now from protests from Al Jazeera.
At least one person's been killed in mass protests taking place across Sudan. Thousands of people are demanding the military hand power to civilians. We can get the very latest now from our correspondent, Hiba Morgan, who's joining us live from Juba. That's in South Sudan. Hiba, bring us right up to date with the situation then in Sudan.
Well, Marceline, just a few minutes ago, the military council, the Transitional Military Council, issued a statement saying that it has handed the Ethiopian mediation team its response to the proposal. The Ethiopian mediation team has been trying to bring together the two sides, the military council and the opposition coalition known as the Forces of Freedom and Change, which is leading the protest on the streets. The military council says that it has accepted the basis of that proposal, which includes a sovereign council. One of the main issues of points of contention between the two sides. Now, that proposal says that there will be a sovereign council made up of civilians, seven members, and military representatives, seven members as well as 15th member, which will be agreed upon by both sides. And the military council is also saying that it is ready to start negotiations as soon as today. We're yet to hear from the opposition coalition known as the Forces of Freedom and Change if they will resume negotiations. What we do know is that there are thousands and thousands of people marching, not just on the streets of Khartoum, but other states as well, saying that they are going to continue with their protests until a civilian-led transitional government is in place. The Sudanese Professionals Association, which has been leading the calls for protests, have directed those in Khartoum to go ahead to the presidential palace to demand a civilian government, as well as accountability for those who were killed on June 3rd when the sitting in front of the armed headquarters was attacked and reported 100 people killed.
All righty. And of course, a clip from Al Jazeera. They are in South Sudan because apparently they have been banned from the Sudan itself, doing their reporting from South Sudan. I would now like to welcome our guests. I'd like to welcome back Dr. Nada Mustafa Ali. She is a scholar and core faculty in the human rights minor at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, affiliate faculty in the John W. McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at the same university. She's working on a digital ethnography on women's social media and activism in contemporary Sudan. Dr. Ali is also researching gender militarization and peace building in Sudan and South Sudan. She's written and published extensively in Arabic and English, and her book, Gender, Race, and Sudan's Exile Politics, Do We All Belong in This Country, was published in 2015. Dr. Nada Mustafa Ali, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for your interest in Sudan.
Okay.
For your support of the Sudanese people.
Thank you. We're also joined by Professor Khalid Mustafa Medani, Associate Professor of Political Science at McGill University, Chair of the African Studies Program. He also has published extensively on political Islam in Sudan, civil conflict, and the roots of the Sudanese uprising. Professor Khalid Mustafa Medani, thank you for joining us.
My honor. Thank you also for your interest in Sudan.
Okay. And what we're going to do now, we heard the clip, which is about the situation that has happened most recently at the time of this interview on Sunday, June 30th. But what I'd like to do, actually, and starting with you, Professor Khalid Mustafa Medani, is it okay if I call you Professor Khalid?
Oh, yes, of course.
Just
absolutely. Yes.
Right.
You can just call me Khalid and without the professor.
Okay, all righty. All right, Khalid. what I'm sure our audience would be very interested in, and Dr. Nada, you may want to weigh in on this also, is just the early history of Sudan, because a lot of people knew really nothing about Sudan until the recent protests broke out. But, you know, what does it mean? I mean, tell us when it is said that the history goes back to the days of pharaohs. I mean, that's a few thousand years before Christ. Khalid.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's a great source of pride to Sudanese and Africans in general. Of course, the long history of Sudan, although it was not called Sudan at the time, is extremely important. I think a lot of your listeners are familiar, of course, with the Kingdom of Nubia and the kingdoms of Kush and Meroe and a number of kingdoms that predate the colonial era and the post-colonial era, which is really important. It is one of course, the kind of longest histories or the most well-known histories in the world, and that's really important to keep in mind. I mean, the prehistoric history of Egypt, so to speak, begins as early as the 7,000 BC, which is a very, very long time, which is really important to keep
My
in
God.
Mind.
Yeah.
So that's really important. The civilization of Kush dates roughly between 785 BC to 350 AD, and it's a very important, of course, history of Sudan that's intertwined, of course, with the history of ancient Egypt, which your listeners, of course, are very familiar with. And that is really important. The civilization of Kush in general ended in the 4th century AD, but during that time there were a number of different kingdoms and city-states that were part and parcel of the kingdom of Kush, including Meroe, which is, of course, in northern Sudan. It was the capital of the Kush kingdom. It's very well known in Sudan. And the reason I mentioned it, it's also during this period under the kingdom of Meroe, which is based in a town called Karima, modern-day Karima in northern Sudan in River Nile State in the north. It's also a kingdom that was known very much for, and I think that Dr. Neda will chime in here, it's very much known for the role of women, especially at the level of leadership. It is, in fact, in Meroe that we know that it wasn't only a kingdom that followed the line of matrilineal succession, that is, women played a really crucial part, but the queen mother, or the Kandaka, that has become so well known and become a slogan not only for Sudanese women, but Sudanese in general, and of course now the whole world, particularly in Africa, that are trying to understand and that term, Kandaka, which refers to the queen mother during the period of Meroe. I emphasize that to just be clear about the continuity with respect to how Sudanese feel about their present history and their linkage to the great civilizations of the past. So Meroe plays a very, very important role. And of course, historically, there's always been an intertwined kind of relationship between Nubia, that area in northern Sudan and southern Egypt, and the ancient Egyptians as well. It's a very complicated and interesting history. But I always emphasize to students and others that, at that time, of course, there was no modern-day Egypt or modern-day Sudan. It really was a territory that was marked by the cataracts of the Nile, from the first to the sixth cataract of the Nile, which is why that kind of area, prior to the imposition of the colonial state, continues to have a kind of very broad reach, not only for Sudanese, but for Egyptians, for Ethiopians, of course now southern Sudanese. But I also wanted to mention that as important as these ancient civilizations are, and of course they are well known for their grandeur and of course their long history, but also for the fact that these were also one of the first, if not the first, literate societies, there were also in Sudan very important, and I think Dr. Neda will agree, other kingdoms and civilizations. There were, of course, and I am partly also from Nubia, from the northern part of the country, and we also know full well from our history that we've also had medieval Christian Nubian kingdoms between roughly 350 BC to all the way to the 1500s AD. And then we've had the Islamic civilizations and kingdoms of Sinnar in the central part of the country, or northern central part, and Darfur, of course, to the west. These are very, very important kingdoms that are really important. And the Funj Sultanate, which is also Islamic kingdom in the central and southern part of the Sudan, that was essentially established but by what you know, or your listeners would know now, as southern Sudanese. So we have a long history of course, relationship to ancient Egypt, the independent history of Nubia and the Kush and Meroe civilizations. But we also have very important central kingdoms that represent the bulk of Sudanese. So while one may be from Nubia and very, very proud, of course, from that history, it's a shared history among all Sudanese, but also there are other kingdoms that encompass other populations throughout what we know as modern-day Sudan and South Sudan. And I think it's extremely important to emphasize that to your listeners as a way for them to understand that this is not just about the Kandakas and the Nubians. That term is used to encompass the entire history of Sudan, which is much more far-reaching, I would argue, than even the Nubian, the great civilizations of Nubia.
Right, and this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and we are having a one-hour special where we are digging deep into not only the history of the Sudan, but we'll be fast-forwarding to the conflict that has broken out there as people are struggling for democracy and for civilian rule. And the voice you just heard was Professor Khalid Mustafa Medani. Now, we'll ask Dr. Nada to weigh in on this on two points. I mean, this idea of the Kandika, is it, or the Queen Mother? And I wonder the importance of that history, even as it played itself out in the images we saw in the recent protests, number one. But number two, to also give us a sense, I mean, when we talk about civilizations going back, and Khalid mentioned, of course, Egypt going back as much as 7,000 years B.C. This was before Christianity. This was also before Islam. So I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit about who the peoples were then that made up Nubia, Kush, Meroe, and also the middle sections, the central kingdoms that were referred to by Khalid. Try to get a sense of how, you know what I mean? There's the Sudan being in North Africa, and then, of course, West and Southern and East Africa, known for people who are Afro, so to speak. Do you know what I mean? So that kind of history, just in terms of the racial makeup at the time in that early history. So Nada, Dr. Nada.
Right, so I think Professor Khalid Medani has actually covered pretty much so much of that history in an eloquent manner. Some of the actors I would mention include King Taharqa, for example. This is one of the well-known kings whose reign can be dated between 690 BC to 664 BC, and he is known as the king of both Egypt and Sudan. There are various Kandakas, such as Amani Shekhtu, Amani Rinas, and others who ruled either as queen mothers or as queens in their own right. And those were actually warrior queens. And I think one of the reasons the protesters, especially women protesters, popularized and reclaimed this title of Kandaka was in order to offset, in order to challenge a certain kind of identity that the government of Omar al-Bashir, who was overthrown, as you said earlier, on the 11th of April 2019. This government ruled for 30 years, almost 30 years, but even before that, in 1983, the former dictator, military ruler of Sudan, Jafar Nimeiri, introduced a certain version of Islam and tried to impose this, you know, idea about, you know, women as being submissive. And of course, it's an, you know, an, it's an interpretation of Islam that is not necessarily reflective of what Islam is about, and it, in its different manifestations in different historical periods. You know, but you know, this image of you know, Sudanese women as reflecting only an Islamist identity, with the aim of serving the ideology of the regimes in power then. Not all Sudanese women agreed with it and challenged it in different ways.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. And just before we really fast forward to a much later period in the history of Sudan, what, you know, even looking at the images of people today in participating in the protests in Sudan. I mean, I'm of African descent myself from the Caribbean region. And I'll have to say that even though Sudan is part of Africa, there were a number of people who were surprised and they said, wow, there are a lot of black people there, right? You know what I mean? Khalid, as though that was like a big discovery in terms of Sudan. Khalid, a comment?
Yeah, well, you know, the it's. I think that the reference to the Kandakas and the queens or that early period also references issues of race. This is a period where, and of course this is debatable, but I think it's quite well known, and I think I always emphasize it to people who are not aware of the history of Sudan, that the issue, of course, of issues of race in itself is, of course, as you know, a very modern phenomenon. And what I mean by that is what we know from that early period of Nubia and even ancient Egypt, of course, and certainly Kush and others, that and the reason I kind of detailed or spelled out some of the various civilizations is that we know there were distinctions linguistically. That is between Kushites who are who speak the Kushite languages and the Nilo-Saharan languages, which is essentially what the Nubian language is. So the distinctions historically prior to the kind of modern era in which there was these divisions between, you know, what you looked like or your skin tone, so to speak, the distinctions were, you know, geographical, of course, and of course had to do with political power and economic livelihood, and linguistic. And so for those of us, for example, who actually happen to be from the area of Nubia with family, of course, who still speak one of the most, the oldest languages in the world, that language itself, the Nilo-Saharan language, has much more in common with southern Sudanese and the Nilotics of southern Sudan. It is really from the same linguistic family, rather than the Semitic language of Arabic, which, of course, comes later, pretty much in the 7th century in Sudan. And the reason I emphasize that is that what you're seeing on your TV screens and videos is really the natural kind of character of Sudanese society. So for those of us who are Sudanese, aware of our history, that is, and I'm not denying the issues of inter-ethnic conflict and racism interjected by successive governments, but really what Sudanese protesters are doing is both in image, sound, and in speech and in their activism, they're going back to the period where, you know, Sudanese were in fact certainly divided by linguistic categorization, but not divided by race. So we are a naturally African country, and those languages, of course, are indigenous African languages. And so I would have to say that the majority of Sudanese, and Dr. Neda can chime in, is that, you know, really do not have kind of any kind of ambivalent or ambiguous relationship to being African or black. But what this protest has really kind of emphasized, and I'm speaking, I think, here on part of the activists that I've spoken to, and that is to make sure to emphasize two things. One of them is that the interjection of race and racism has been really a project of the modern era, and has been one that was utilized to divide and rule by successive governments. That is the so-called Arabs versus Africans. That's the number one point they want to really undermine and make sure the world knows that that is not the case. And the other is to say that just as women have a historically natural role in politics at the very high level and throughout society, both in the public as well as the private sphere, also, the issue of divisions along color, along race, is not the natural will progress. Not it doesn't conform to the long history of Sudan, and it certainly does not and cannot be something that will move Sudan forward. So as much as we're proud of our long history, we're also proud of our diversity in Sudan. And so, and of course, being black is something that is part and parcel of our long history, of the Kushite history, of the Meadowy history. But it's also a society that is very diverse linguistically, in ethnic terms. And that is something that the activists really want to address. And this is why you find such popularity and unanimity among all of the Sudanese not only in Khartoum, but throughout the regions, in the north, in the west, southern Sudanese, in the Nuba Mountains, Nubians, and other ethnic groups coming together as one. And it is also the reason, I think your question is important, why now we have solidarity and people protesting standing with Sudanese and their revolution in Ghana, in Kenya, in the Cameroon, in South Africa. And now, of course, you see the African Union playing a central role. And so as many people have asked me, my African sisters and brothers, when will Sudan come back to Africa? My response has always been, well, we never left.
Absolutely. And we're going to have to take our station break. And then, Dr. Nada, we do want to hear more from you wrapping up this kind of historic piece. But just a note that Dr. Joy DeGruy, who does the post-traumatic slave syndrome analysis and work, she also says that race is it's a relatively new invention, right? And in so many ways, it was used to justify dehumanization and slavery that happened in the chattel slave era here in the Americas. So interesting, the history that you say about race being a modern phenomenon and the early incredible history of the Sudan, its relationship with Egypt, etc. We're going to continue this discussion, but we're going to take a short station break. And stay tuned, because Dr. Nada Mustafa Ali and Professor Khalid Mustafa Madani will continue to be with us as we discuss the Sudan and moving into what is happening now. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Sojourner Truth. That music you just heard, protest music from the Sudan. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Check out our website at www.sotrueradio.org. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook as well. And we're also worldwide on SoundCloud. And in our tradition, we want to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners. Let's see, today let's do Clifton, New Jersey in the United States. Clifton, New Jersey. And internationally, let's give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Vietnam. Vietnam, SoundCloud listeners there. We are continuing our in-depth discussion about the Sudan, and our guests are Dr. Nada Mustafa Ali and Professor Khalid Mustafa Madani. And we're just wrapping up putting Sudan in the historic context here. And Dr. Nada, back to you on this, because as you, in terms of your earlier comment too about the role that women played in the protests, and I wonder if you want to tell us a bit more about that, because The Guardian is reporting that in some instances as many as 70% of the protesters were women. And when we think of the Arab Spring, for example, when we think of when it broke out in Tahrir Square in Egypt and then spread to other places, then brutally put down, of course, we did see some women, but overwhelmingly we saw men. And there's also the image of the great oppression of women so that they can't even participate in protests. So a lot of people are also surprised when they saw the percentage and visibility and the leadership in some many cases of women. Dr. Nada.
Okay. Thank you. I think this is a very important question, and because I consider, gender as a social construct, just as race, and that it intersects with race as well, maybe I should just make a brief comment about the issue of race, the earlier discussion.
Yeah.
I do think that race is a modern phenomenon as a concept, and that it's a social and cultural construct. But I think that it's also rooted in exploitative and unequal power relationships oftentimes, and that it is oftentimes used to subjugate and to control certain communities and certain groups. And so I have in mind, obviously, slavery and also colonialism. Sudan is a former colony of Britain, which ruled Sudan between 1896 and 55-56. During this time, because of the British approach to ruling colonized communities, they oftentimes employ the divide and rule approach, and also they rule through local administrations, the local administrative structures. And so they actually strengthen some of the local chiefs and rulers in northern Sudan to help them subjugate the rest of the population. And this has actually contributed to the dominance of certain racial groups over others in Sudan. And that contributed to that construction of Sudan's identity as predominantly Arab, for example, and the silencing of other expressions of our identity and our languages, as Professor Khalid Madani said earlier. And this is important to take into account, because women oftentimes are considered as, border markers, as sociologists would tell us, between different ethnic groups. And in that, and as such, various, governments in Sudan, including the government of Omar al-Bashir, used women to really construct a certain identity of Sudan, so imposed a certain dress code on women and so on. In that, taking all that into account, I would say that women in different parts of Sudan have played important roles in resistance, in resisting colonialism. Al-Azza, Ahmed Abdullah, and Hawa At-Tattara, two women who were active, as Sudan was negotiating its independence from Britain. So the flag of Sudan, there were women who were active in terms of supporting the male politicians at the time, and also in their own rights in terms of grassroots organizing. Women were very active in opposing two dictatorships in Sudan, the rule of General Ibrahim Aboud between 1958 and 1964. They were very active after, the revolution that overthrew that dictatorship in 1964. We had our very first female parliamentarian in Africa at the time, Fatma Ahmed Ibrahim. And then in 1985, women were also actively opposing the rule of Jafar Nimeiri. Of course, during that time, there was not, the revolution of the internet had not occurred. And so, of course, there was not that much documentation of these roles that women played. Women did play an important role during the Arab protests in Egypt and elsewhere as well. I oftentimes, show my students the video of Asma Mahfouz on the 25th of calling and mobilizing Egyptians to go to Tahrir Square for the sit-in on the 25th of January. And there were other Egyptian women who were very active in that revolution. In Sudan, also, women have been active throughout the years of Bashir. They have paid very high prices for that. They were arrested. They experienced sexual violence in detention. In Darfur, women's bodies were used as a battleground, and rape was widespread, obviously. Women also were part of various peace movements in Sudan, in Darfur and elsewhere. In South Sudan, women before South Sudan seceded during the war, which the second war, which lasted between 1983 and 2005, women held whole communities together in South Sudan, in displaced communities, in northern cities, and also in neighboring countries and in exile. And those women also formed very powerful organizations that also tried to play important roles in politics and in society.
Right.
And so this is really not exceptional. This is not exceptional. And I think that what is missing now is that women should also have a voice in envisioning what a future Sudan would look like in terms of political participation in various governance structures, but also in terms of putting together a constitution, taking part in a constitution making process, in terms of revising laws that discriminate against women, and so on and so forth.
Right, and very important points there, and some of the women's groups that we've read about that are involved heavily is No to the Oppression of Women Initiative and the Civil and Political Feminist Groups. I'm sure there are likely others, but Dr. Nada, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I can't think of any movement, certainly that I've known about or have been involved in, where women have not been central to it. That doesn't mean that the visibility of women is often seen, particularly in the leadership roles, because we have found that even within movements for change, there is sexism, right? There's misogyny, there's sexism that's going on that women have to face. So I'm sure that you're absolutely right. This isn't exceptional, and a lot more women were involved in the Arab Spring than we saw in terms of what the Western media covered. But you also talked about Northern Sudan and Southern Sudan, and before we talk to the makeup, who are the people right now in the military junta ruling Sudan, for us to get some little understanding of what happened with the partitioning of Sudan. I mean, Southern Sudan, the United States did support, from what I gather, that partitioning and that division. We know that Southern Sudan is also very rich in oil. But then there was the whole, you made reference to the Janjaweed and the numbers of how women's bodies were used, and reports. We've had reports of, like, between 2003 and 2008, CNN is reporting that at least 300,000 people were killed and 3 million displaced during the Darfur conflict between rebel groups and the government. Just Nada, maybe starting with you, can you shed some light on what was going on here with the power relations and then the subsequent partitioning division?
Sure. Obviously, the problem of Sudan, I wouldn't say of South Sudan, did not start. Did not start really in 2005, for example, when the government, the National Islamic Front National Congress Party government of Bashir, signed a peace agreement with the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, which led, the struggle of the South Sudanese at the time. This conflict dates back to the 1950s, and it is rooted partially or partly in Sudan's colonial history and the use of the policy of divide and rule and indirect rule, which I discussed earlier. But it's also rooted in the way successive governments in Sudan have actually controlled power. They were elites that were predominantly male and predominantly from certain parts of Sudan, the riverine areas and some of the northern cities of Sudan, the northern parts of Sudan. These elites actually excluded wide communities from in eastern Sudan, in western Sudan, in the far north, even and obviously in South Sudan. When the resistance started in South Sudan in 1955, the main agenda was to secede, was secession of South Sudan. And then in 1972, the then military regime of Jafar Nimeiri negotiated a peace agreement with the Anyanya movement, which led the war at the time. And there a period of 10 years of relative peace followed, but this period ended in 1983. That was when oil was discovered in Sudan. And at the time, Jafar Nimeiri actually decided to build the refinery, the oil refinery, in the Kosti, which is in the northern part of Sudan. He also divided or redivided South Sudan into certain administrative units that the then Anyanya did not see as helpful. And finally, obviously, at the time, that military ruler found out that he ran out of ways to legitimize his rule, so he reached out to the Islamists and introduced a strict version of Sharia in Sudan. And so there was a riot in southern Sudan. And the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, an army, were formed, led at the time by the late Dr. John Garang Dimabior. And at first, the ideology of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement really was about uniting Sudan on a new basis. So they wanted to restructure Sudan's politics and economy, so they are more inclusive of people in different parts of Sudan, especially in South Sudan. So development projects are not concentrated in the northern cities.
Yeah.
And this war continued until 2005, when the government of Bashir concluded a peace agreement with the Sudan People Liberation Movement, and the idea, and also, of course, with other movements that were fighting the government, carrying arms, including movements in eastern Sudan, and also the National Democratic Alliance, which was an alliance of political parties that were in opposition to the government. And so the idea was to have a transitional period that would end in 2010-2011. During this period, the government in the north would of course, the Sudan People Liberation Movement would be represented in this government, and South Sudan would have relative autonomy. But then everybody would work, especially the government would work towards showing good faith, and with the expectation that at the referendum, which took place in 2011. Would result in a united Sudan, Sudan that is united on new basis. Unfortunately, of course, this did not happen, and it was expected, because it would be very difficult to show good faith while the National Congress Party held power and dominated power at the time, and so the people of South Sudan voted overwhelmingly for secession.
Yeah.
I personally wanted South Sudan and Sudan to remain united. You know, we are thinking, in terms of the power that arises from unity of communities, right, and of African countries and the African diaspora and so on, pan-Africanism. But then at the same time, the people of South Sudan had the right to self-determination, and they practiced this right, and they achieved independence as a result. Of course, this meant also that oil, as you said earlier, which is mainly in south, in most of the oil fields are in
You are
south
listening
Sudan.
To KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Listener-supported community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation